I'm going to begin with the awful situation in Gaza. As comrades will know, Israel has not only been bombing the south, where it told people from the north to evacuate to, we now have ground operations in Khan Yunis and predictably, we have the United Nations estimating that some half the population of Gaza face the danger of starvation. Before, of course, people die of hunger, what tends to happen is that we catch diseases of one kind or another, and you would have thought that conditions in Gaza were as near perfect in that respect than you can get. I mean, not only is there a shortage of fuel and food, there's also shortage of drinking water. So what the hell people are drinking, I don't know. But of course, what that creates is the ideal conditions for diseases, for epidemics. And of course, we have the collapse of the health system in Gaza. And of course, the inability of aid agencies to step in any meaningful way. So while at the moment, we're getting a terrible, terrible, death rate. What's the figure? I don't know. Is it 15,000? Obviously, going up to 16,000. But the conditions are there, they're in place very quickly to put a naught at the end of that figure. So once disease takes a grip, then what we're dealing with is not hundreds of deaths a day. We'd be dealing with thousands and thousands of deaths per day. In terms of the United States, it looks at this situation and is telling Israel that not only its bombings and attacks on the ground are disproportionate, it actually has laid down the law, so we're told. That Israel must finish its operations in Gaza by the end of the year. Everything that you hear from Israel says that they ain't willing to do that, that they will take not to the end of the year, but another year before they fully eliminate Hamas, if that was the aim, which I don't really think it is. It's clearly not to eliminate one particular political organization in Gaza. It's about actually removing the Gazan population from Gaza and getting them to break through into Egypt in order to get relief in terms of food, medical help, water in the Sinai. Now, we ought to say, at least this is me, this is my angle on it, that the United States is shedding crocodile tears over the deaths and, short-term possibility of deaths on a absolutely massive scale. My own take on it is that that's not what they're concerned about. What they're concerned about is the effect, the potential effect that such a level of fatalities in Gaza will have in the Middle Eastern region. And what I refer to specifically is those states that are allied to the United States. So first and foremost, it's Egypt. The Sisi regime, I think, is the second largest recipient of US military aid. But of course, the Sisi regime is unstable, and the Egyptian mass is looking at what's going on, on their border. At some point, we'll start doing something about it. What? I haven't got a clue, but I think that's the calculation in the White House. And what goes for Egypt, I think, goes for Saudi Arabia. How stable is the MBS regime? You ask the question, you already know the answer. What about the Hashemite monarchy, Abdullah II, in Jordan? What about to the north of Israel in Lebanon? I don't know what the government there is, if they have anything that approaches any sort of genuine government. But clearly, what we're talking about is extreme instability. And I think that's what's driving the Americans. And we shouldn't have any illusions in the ability of the United States to use a phrase, switch off the tap. It's not about US military aid to Israel, which I don't know what that amounts to per year. It'd be $4, $5, $6 billion dollars. I don't know. It's not so much that that will persuade Israel. It's the United States switching off new supplies of artillery and tank shells. It's the United States switching off supplies of Patriot missiles and other such surface to air missiles. It's the United States stopping the supply of spare parts for the planes that are bombing Gaza as I speak. So F-16s, F-35s. In terms of my, writing on Ukraine, I was, startled. I didn't realize it, that when you take an F-16 plane, for example, for every hour that it's up there in the sky, it takes something like 12 hours, 24 hours maintenance on the ground in order to put it back in the sky. And it's not just a question of oiling the parts, it's about replacing parts. And of course, those parts come from the United States. So the United States can cut off supplies of artillery shells, missiles, but also spare parts that modern aircraft need after remarkably little time actually in operation. So who knows? Between the United States' worries about the regional instability and Israel's determination to carry out an act of ethnic cleansing on, on the population in Gaza. Who knows what the timetable is? But the danger is precisely that the longer this thing goes on, disease breaks out, and then we would be talking about something that can only possibly be described surely as genocide. Because if you look at governments, it's not a question of, we didn't do it. The Israelis are presiding over the conditions of where such a thing can happen. Gaza is surrounded on every side on the land by Israeli controlled posts. It's surrounded in the sea by the sea, along its coast by Israeli patrol boats. Israel is responsible, in other words, for what goes on, the fact that aid hasn't been coming in. That's Israel's responsibility. So Israel is going to be responsible for mass deaths. And what I'm talking about, as I've already said, isn't 15,000, but extremely quickly, the danger is that that figure can go up to 150,000 and more. Okay, just a note on that. Some of us were out on the demonstration in London yesterday, the Stop the War Coalition, Palestine Solidarity, the MAB, other such organizations. They claim 100,000 out on the streets of London. And I'm in no position to actually say whose figures are right. Was that figure right, or was the police claim that there were 40,000? All you know is that there's a habitual difference between what the police say and what organisers claim. But the point I would just add to that is that one, demonstrations such as that do matter. It does manifest what public opinion is. And the demonstration the previous week, a few weeks ago, of 800,000 being claimed by the organizers. I mean, clearly that was one of the biggest demonstrations in British history. Now, what was notable to me as someone who watched the demonstration pass by from the beginning, not quite to the end, was the gaps in the columns. And at the end, the whole thing was straggled out. And I remarked, about that to other comrades, and we all sort of swapped our anecdotes about armies and how, the lead troops in any column have to march slower because those behind them can only but march slower than they do. And if they march according to their own pace, they leave the people behind. And myself and other comrades on the demonstration, we were complaining about the stewarding, and that's Chris Nynham of Counterfire, ex-SWP, that surely as a very experienced organizer of demonstrations, he should know to keep the front holding back, slow it down, stop it, wait for the back to catch up. But then I was reading that the police, in terms of the conditions for allowing this demonstrations to go ahead, have not only sort of issued instructions, warning about this slogan or that slogan, which I'll come to in a little while, not only issued warnings about what areas were permitted and what areas weren't permitted. So no demonstrators were allowed anywhere near the Israeli embassy. For example, that was one of the preconditions of the march. But another precondition, which explains Chris Nynham and his behavior as chief steward, was that they put a time limit on the demonstration. And the police insisted that the speakers had to finish by 4 o'clock and everyone had to disperse by five. And I think that explained why the front marched on ahead so that they could get to the Whitehall, the speakers could start, and the last speaker could finish by 4 o'clock. And this really brings me to the whole question of the propaganda war that we're in at the moment, and the whole question of how should you put it, legal creep. That's going on in Britain and other countries. So we know, don't we, that while there has been official, put it like that, so-called anti-Semitism demonstrations in France and in Germany, pro-Palestinian marches have been banned. And indeed, under our previous Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, clearly, there was an element in the government, not least in the Home Office, that was trying to press forward with a similar sort of order being issued in Britain. And of course, we had the nonsense, didn't we, about the demonstration, invading Whitehall in the middle of the commemorations around the cenotaph and all the rest of it. just wouldn't have happened, didn't happen, of course, but the sort of hysteria that was being built up was palpable. And government ministers and opposition figures even were all voicing opinions about that. But also, what we've had in terms of accompanying, for example, this vote triggered by the General Secretary of the United Nations, this Security Council vote, is we've had an Israeli propaganda counter offensive. So we all know the vote in the UN Security Council, one vote against, one crucial vote against, which was the United States, which of course basically stymies the Security Council. It's a permanent member. It can veto any vote. Britain abstained, and as far as I know, France would have voted actually for the call for a ceasefire. But accompanying that, we've had a, as I said, an Israeli propaganda counter-offensive. And I want to be careful what I'm saying here, because I don't want to be misunderstood. But I found it interesting that Israel has hit back at the UN for not taking the rape of women seriously in terms of the Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other organizations, their actions on October the 7th. And, I was listening to a BBC report, and it was introduced. This is the 5 o'clock news, so it lasts, what, three quarters of an hour or thereabouts. But anyway, they introduced their item on this question that the BBC had got proof of rapes associated with the October the 7th action. I listened to it. I was expecting horror stories. I heard horror stories. War is horrible. War is foul. But what I found interesting was that the reporter, as opposed to those that wrote the headline for this story, that their actual report from inside Israel basically said that there is no proof, that what there is there's anecdotal evidence that any proof that there was has either not been collected or has been destroyed in terms of burials and flames. That was the story. So yes, there was anecdotal evidence of rape, but nothing more. So instead of having the story as well, actually, there is no hard evidence. We had the exact opposite. Now, I haven't got a clue what the truth is. I'd be very surprised myself that an army, and I'll treat Hamas as an army that's let loose. If you look at the film that Israel has transmitted, in terms of October the 7th, what you've got is, not disciplined columns, not tightly organized bodies of armed men. It's much more loose. It's much more, how should I put it, chaotic. What's going on? You've got people have been in effect let out of a cage, and they want to kill, kill, kill. And of course, that's what they proceeded to do. I'm sure Israel was also responsible for some Israeli deaths on that day. I don't know what the proportions would be, but okay, I can go along with that story. And I'm also quite prepared to go along with the idea that an army under such conditions, the rank and file of an army without officers over them committed atrocious crimes. And I'm quite prepared to except that rape was part of that. But that's very different from saying that that was their instructions, that this was sort of part of the plan. And if it was part of the plan precisely, then we actually need proof on that question. And just to add a final point on this, there's an awful lot from the United States demanding the condemnation of Hamas and insisting that Israel has the right of self-defense. Well, my understanding is, and I'm not a lawyer, so lawyers maybe will come in and correct me, that the conditions that I've described in Gaza are the conditions of an occupied people. These people are not free to come and go. They're not free to enter into diplomatic relations with their neighbors. This is occupied territory, and the same applies to the West Bank of Palestine. What we have is Israel after 1967, not only annexing East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, they've been ceding colonies on the West Bank. We've all seen the maps of disappearing Palestinian territory. Meanwhile, the population in Gaza, to all intents and purposes, exist in an open prison. And the point about that is that under international law, for whatever that is worth, and I don't rate it as being anything sacred myself, international law is about who's strong, got nothing to do actually, with normal courts. But the point would be that under international law, people under those conditions have the right to resist. And that's actually what the Palestinian people, including their organizations such as Hamas, have been doing. That doesn't mean we need to dress up Hamas or Islamic Jihad into being political organizations that they aren't. But clearly, they are part of a national resistance movement. So I just thought it was worthwhile commenting on the fallout from this rape story, because I'm not normally a listener to Owen Jones, the Guardian columnist. I don't know how many followers he's got. Certainly, he's got a lot more followers than we've got on this forum. But he actually was invited, he was amongst the journalists invited to the Israeli embassy for a showing of their film, the IDF film, 47 minutes of all the gory details of the October the 7th action. And he actually then came home and did a broadcast to his followers where he said, well, yeah, what I saw was horrendous, the blood, the bodies, the death. This really was disturbing. But he said that when it came to the question of rape, and I'm coming back to this story, where was the evidence? And of course, as a result of that, there's been a storm of criticism of Owen Jones. Apparently, he's a misogynist. He's an anti-Semite. And to me, as I've said, I think that this is a story that no doubt has got some truth to it. But it's a bit like the stories of babies beheaded. Were babies decapitated? I'm sure. But how many babies were deliberately executed by Hamas? That story was withdrawn, remember, after it came out of the mouth of Joe Biden himself. And in my view, what we're dealing with here is something of the equivalent of the rape of Belgian nuns by the German army in 1914. I'd be very surprised if nuns weren't raped by Germans in 1914. But the idea that that characterized their operation, which is how it's pushed in Britain, how it's pushed in France, that's a different question entirely. Anyway, the point I'm making is that clearly what we're in is not only a war between armed bodies and between the Israeli so-called defense force and the civilian population in Gaza. We're also in the class war of ideas. We're dealing with, the first casualty in war is truth. I think that is most certainly true. But also, what's been going on is that the boundaries of definition are being stretched and pushed and pulled. I always expected it. Nonetheless, the vote in the US House of Representatives, the actual vote didn't come as a surprise to me, but the margin, maybe I'm naive, but the margin did. We had a vote on a resolution that defined anti-Zionism as anti-Semitism, carried, let me get it right, by 311 votes for against 14, with, to use American parliamentary language, I think it's correct, 92 people present, which means in our terms, abstentions. So, in other words, what we had is a split in the Democrat Party. Some voted against. My understanding is one of the 14 was a Republican, a Jewish Republican. These people, at least had some, moral courage. But what we have with the Democrats is either a complete lack of moral courage or complicity voting for this motion, which also went on to say that the slogan "From the River to the Sea" is also anti-Semitic, because what it entails is the eradication of the Jewish people in Israel. And of course, it doesn't, and nor is anti-Zionism anti-Semitism. We all know our history, especially now, given, how should you put it, the years since 2015, when we had Jeremy Corbyn elected the leader of the Labour Party in Britain. We've all done our, history spade work. And of course, we all know about the Bund, the first working class organisation in Poland and in the Russian Empire. We all know about the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks, how at least surely half their central committee were Jewish. But not only were they were anti-Bund, of course they were anti Zionist. Zionism was a minority in terms of European politics, world politics, really, until sometime, I would suggest, after the Holocaust. And I can't give you exact dates or exact figures, but I think that's most certainly true. So Zionism was looked at as slightly nutty. That's the impression I get, from reading, mainstream social democrats, and I include in mainstream social democracy, for my present purposes, I include the Bund, both in Poland and in Russia, in that particular respect. So yeah, what's the slogan, "From the River to the Sea"? Well, in general, you can't say 100%, but in general, the people who use that slogan are looking for a one-state solution. And of course, the people that shout it tend to be socialistic, tend to be left-wing, they tend to be secular. And what they mean by it is a situation where people of all religions, all nationalities, will live alongside each other as equals, which isn't the case in Zionist Israel, of where people are treated differently. Israel at the moment is a Zionist state, which means anyone. I don't know exactly how much so-called Jewish blood you need, but not very much. Your spouse, for example, can be classified as Jewish, and that gives you, this is the case with Russian migrants, gives you the right to come with them to settle in Israel. At the same time that we have people who are born in Israel stroke Palestine, if they leave, as for example, if the Gazan population left voluntarily, i.e., because they were starving, would they be allowed back to the land of their ancestors, the land of their birth? No. And we then get into all sorts of other rights and non-rights that separate the Jewish population in Israel from the Palestinian stroke Arab population. So we have this vote in the US Congress, in the House of Representatives, and it really does, as I said, as such, it comes as no surprise to me. The margin, as I said, does surprise me, but the actual vote, because all we need to do is look at the international, well, so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance so-called definition of anti-Semitism, along with all its extraordinary examples, to know that what's going on is a shift of meaning. That anti-Semitism goes from holding prejudiced views, hostile views towards Jews, viewing Jews as either sinister or inferior, something along those lines, to a situation where to disagree, to criticize Israel, in effect, becomes an example of anti-Semitism, which falls under various laws. And if it doesn't fall under various laws, what we have is governments in various parts of the Western world that are extraordinarily keen to extend the law so that that definition covers any sort of criticism, either of the existence of Israel, but also the actions of Israel. And I just wanted to give you an example of that. I'm sure other comrades have looked it up, but on a recent demonstration, four comrades were arrested. And the reason I'm singling them out is clear, that they were arrested for selling a book on their bookstall. This is the bookstall of the Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist. One of the comrades who was arrested was Jyoti, not Jyoti, what's his name? Sanjid. No, is it Sanjid? Rajid. Why don't I remember his name? Rajid Brar, he's the son. Thank you, Gabby. He's the son of Harpal Brar, the founder of this organization. Now, what he didn't write the book, by the way. He was just on the bookstall. And there you are, there the police come up, they look at this book, they look at the cover. And what you have, from my understanding of it, because I saw it sort of third hand, the sort of video that they took of the arrest. My understanding is that what you had is a piece of artwork that showed the Star of David, the star that's in the middle of the Israeli flag, combined with the crooked cross, combined with the swastika, which of course is an image that Hitler adopted from Hindu religion, language, or whatever, I'm not quite sure, Sanskrit perhaps. Either way, it was a religious, it had religious importance. That's my understanding of it in India. You can see Indians today walking around with swastikas. It's quite a shock if you actually go there and you don't know what you're seeing. You think people are pro-Nazi or some sort of version of the BJP. They're not. Anyway, the point would be that if you went to Israel, what you'd find in terms of the Israeli Jewish press, all sorts of accusations of this organization or that organization. It's not only fascist, but all sorts of charges of being Nazi. There are some genuine, I don't know how you'd explain it, Nazi Zionists. I mean, how you explain that, I'm not quite sure. But nonetheless, what I'm talking about isn't the far fringes. I'm talking about sort of mainstream press, mainstream media, that these charges and countercharges are just part of the culture. And it's very understandable why it's part of the culture. But in the same way that if we look at British culture, what's the sort of defining myth of modern day Britain? It's not the Empire. It's not 1066. It's not 16, what was it? The glorious revolution. It's nothing to do with that. No, it's World War II, our finest hour, and how Britain beat the Nazis and saved Europe from Hitler's tyranny. And therefore, in terms of British consciousness as well, the use of Nazism as a device to criticize, as a device to, how should I put it, highlight one's objection to something is embedded in our culture. So the fact that Ranjit and three other comrades were arrested is deeply disturbing. And as I said, I think 2 weeks ago, there was a young woman of Saudi origins who claimed to pick up a homemade placard. And the placard said something along the lines of "Israel, burn in hell." She was arrested and she was fined in Westminster Magistrates Court, I think, 200, £300. Well, it's not my slogan. It's not my artwork, but to me, the call for Israel to burn in hell, given what it's doing, is a perfectly legitimate opinion to hold and to express. To me, when you look at what Israel has been doing and what Israel seems to be prepared to do to the population of Gaza, and surely the West Bank, in one way or another, will follow. I think it's legitimate in terms of propaganda to highlight the danger of what can easily, so easily happen over the next few weeks to precisely use imagery of mass destruction of people by the Hitler regime. I think that that is a perfectly valid thing to do. Now, as I say, they are not my slogans, they're not my artwork, but precisely where we're going at the moment in Britain is towards a situation of where, anti-Zionism is equated with anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is claimed to be a crime, not a viewpoint, not a mistaken viewpoint, but a crime under criminal law. And then what do you start doing? You start banning demonstrations, you start arresting people, you start closing down publications. That seems to me a real danger of where we're going. And it was why I think we were absolutely right at the beginning of this campaign, which I've already located, with the election. Of Jeremy Corbyn. They tried everything, didn't they? He was a Hamas sympathizer. That didn't work. He was a Czech spy. Of course, he was wanting to relive the 1970s. None of that worked. But what worked, because they were disarmed on the question, is the charges of anti-Semitism. And indeed, what we saw is the tragedy of Corbyn and his allies. People like John Landsman, who's now gone and done, I suppose, the right thing in terms of his actual convictions and joined the Jewish labor movement, Zionist. organization, Pole Zion, was its original name, that these people actually not only didn't hit back, they actually became agents in the witch hunt itself. So we had Jeremy Corbyn, to all intents and purposes, urging on the witch hunt and watching as one friend, and I am talking about friends, I am talking about comrades, were thrown under the bus of this witch hunt. And Jenny Formby, the General Secretary appointed under Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party, boasted about speeding up cases, in terms of charges, spurious, false charges of anti-Semitism. Hundreds of people were kicked out, thousands of people left in disgust. And we were right, I think, absolutely right, from the very beginning when we saw Jackie Walker, when we saw Mark Wadsworth, when we saw Tony Greenstein, when we saw Stan Keeble targeted in this witch hunt to say what it was. It was a witch hunt. But it was a witch hunt not only designed to bring down Jeremy Corbyn, who is in danger, perhaps as an outside possibility, but it was there, becoming British Prime Minister. But also, it was about something bigger, and it was about the establishment really, how should you put it, shoring up the Anglo-American alliance that took such a battering under Tony Blair with the lies of the Iraq War and the human results of the Iraq War. I don't know how many people died, maybe we'll never know. But one thing we do know is that the 45 minutes and weapons of mass destruction were surely lies. Either way, what we saw, in terms of this anti-Semitism campaign, was something that any honest person could see through. And that is why it was so disturbing to see so many on the left either joining in the witch hunt or saying, well, you can't have smoke without fire. And I come back to Owen Jones, for example. He actually wrote a book on Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party, of where he had a chapter talking about Labour's anti-Semitism crisis. Now, I agree that it had a, and what I'm doing is putting quote marks around it, had a anti-Semitism crisis, but it had no crisis of anti-Semitism. I'm sure there were anti-Semites in the Labour Party, but they must have been so few and far between, right? I never came across them, right? And if you looked, I'm sure you would have found more anti-Semites on the right than you would have found on the left. That what we were dealing with, of course, wasn't an anti-Semitism crisis. What we were dealing with is a witch hunt of the left under the name of combating anti-Semitism. And that has been extended till we see the results, as I said, in Germany and in France, in the US Congress, and in the creep that's going on in the legal system that is finding people guilty of anti-Semitic race crimes when, well, they might be guilty under the law. But where actually what we're dealing with is honest and fair political comment. Okay, let's just move on. Okay, yeah, that's enough. Okay, so what time have we got? 45. Right, I'll start to wrap up. Thought it was worthwhile commenting on the Tories and their migration policy crisis. I don't think that's a an exaggeration. We of course had the court judgment on their legislation. We've had new legislation drafted, new legislation promised for the House of Commons, and obviously then the House of Lords. We've also had, not uninterestingly, Bill Cash from the right of the party, who's got a lawyer's opinion, and we're not just talking about any old lawyer, who's given a judgment saying, well, I think that this present draft bill will be challenged in the courts and will fail before the courts. We've also had, adding to Sunak's woes, the Rwandan government saying, well, if this policy falls foul of human rights laws, we're going to pull out. Well, precisely, in order to make this policy, this goddamn inhuman policy of deporting people to Rwanda, to make that work, Britain would have to pull out of the European Court of Human Rights. And to do that, of course, what you then have is a whole series of crises relating to Northern Ireland, and I don't know what. And of course, what you've now had, adding or completing maybe Sunak's woes, is the resignation of the migration minister, former migration minister now, of course, Robert Jenrick, who's saying this legislation is unworkable. He's obviously part of the lobby to break with post-World War II European legal architecture. But also we've had the news, which is just gobsmacking, isn't it? The news that having originally budgeted for £140 million for this policy of deporting people, from Heathrow to Rwanda, the price tag now has increased to 290 million, without one aircraft taking off, without one migrant being deposited in Rwanda. You couldn't make it up, could you? So it does strike me. I mean, I could be wrong, but it does strike me that the wheels are falling off the Sunak government, and the resignation of Jenrick basically joining with Suella Braverman, who obviously was sacked, got herself sacked. This has got to do with the post Sunak Tory party. This isn't about the forthcoming general election. This is about the struggle for the Tory party itself, and we need to understand it in that context. Okay, just a very quick comment. TUC Special Congress yesterday at Congress House. This was the trade union bureaucracy, in essence, getting together to say how they're going to resist the latest anti-trade union laws. This is the minimum service level, which is going to be imposed on train drivers, RMT members. So that's ticket offices, signalers, you name it. But also, it's going to be extended to universities, teachers, hospitals, firefighters. Are going to fall under its remit. And what the TUC has come out with is the big bright idea of naming and shaming, it says. So any employer that uses this legislation, they will name and shame them. So if we look at the privatized rail companies, they're going to be shamed, apparently, if they use this legislation. I don't really think that's a fighting strategy. They've also got the agreement of, as I understand it, of the administrations in Wales and Scotland not to use this legislation, and a whole series of Labour mayors. So, Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester, and similar mayors, Liverpool, I'd guess, Birmingham, I'm guessing, also pledging Sadiq Khan in London, we're not going to use this legislation. But what you haven't got is a fighting strategy. So they're not going to actually break the law. And I think that is what is required, not as a principle, but as a willingness. And after all, we've now had a history of many years of resisting, both successfully at the beginning and then unsuccessfully, anti-trade union legislation. So it's true, at least my memory, if unless my memory is doing tricks on me, the TUC got the Labour government to rescind Thatcher's banning of trade unions at GCHQ, the spy agency. She banned trade unions. The Labour Party reinserted trade union rights. But that's about the only thing I can really think of. But the one that comes to my mind is the TUC, Special TUC 1971, that pledged itself to resist and including taking illegal action, resist the Industrial Relations Act of the Edward Heath Tory government. And of course, most famously, that culminated in the arrest, and they courted it, the arrest of five Dockers leaders in 1972, the Pentonville Five. They were locked up in Pentonville prison. And of course, what happened is that I was going to use the word spontaneously, but maybe that's not quite the word I'm looking for. What happened is hundreds of thousands of workers came out on strike, and they were brought out on strike fundamentally because the Communist Party of Great Britain, the old Communist Party, the official Communist Party, brought them out, had the organization in workplaces, had shop stewards, had conveners. It had its fair share also of trade union tops, but crucially, it was rooted in the workplaces, and it managed to bring out huge numbers of workers to the point where the TUC, against the slogans of the IS, the organization that became the SWP in Britain, the TUC threatened to call a one-day general strike unless the Pentonville Five were released. They'd organized an illegal action. They hadn't had a ballot. They hadn't, hadn't had all the consultations and the cooling off period or whatever the hell it happened to be that you were required to. They hadn't, their trade union wasn't officially registered as a trade union. The only trade union of any significance that did register, according to the law, was the Electricians Union, led, if my memory serves me right, by a guy called Frank Chappell. Might have been dead by then, but I think it was Frank Chappell. Either way, what then happened is that these five were released. There was celebration, outside the prison. They were carried away in triumph, and it made those laws completely ineffective. Ted Heath no longer implemented those laws. So whatever was on the so-called statute book, it was an irrelevance. The working class beat those laws. Trade union and general secretaries, of course, will tell me, and it's true, the level of density of trade unions is down massively. The number of workers massively increased since 1972 in Britain. But what I will say, the crucial difference between now and then is that whatever its faults, whatever its limitations, and they were many, what we had is something that you could call a party, i.e., the Communist Party, the official Communist Party. That could make a difference in a way that our present fragmented left, our much reduced left, cannot make that difference. So, if I was going to pick out one thing and one thing alone that needs to accompany all the good resolutions that the left are putting forward, about a demonstration, about organizing in a way that defies the law, the crucial thing, the number one thing that I would add to that list is the unity of the left on a principled, programmatic basis, i.e. around a principled communist program. And on that, I'm going to take up my last 5 minutes. We'll put it up on our website. You can read it on another website. I'll give you details of that. The other week, I was saying to comrades that we'd written not only a rejoinder to the article from Talking About Socialism, which we'd published in the Weekly Worker, but that we hadn't received a reply. Well, we now have received a reply. We will print it in the Weekly Worker. We will put it on the website. We will reply to it, but you can read it if you want it. Of course, it will be up for available to CPGB members, but you can read it on the website of TAS, TAS. I can't remember what their full title is. I won't take more than 4 minutes, Gabby, to deal with it and what our reply to it is. We will obviously, well, I say we will be replying it at length. We won't be, I don't think we're planning to reply at length. Basically, what the argument is a long letter. Good God, it's over 3,000 words. It approaches 4,000 words. But basically, what it consists of, other than a series of really silly, utterly trivial, childish points, you know, does, what's his bloody name? Does, I don't know, does Harvey, the guy that wrote our aggregate report, does he exist? But basically what the comrades have written is 4,000 words of, we are tough guys. We've been in politics a long time. We've got thick skins, but we're not going to talk to you because you're rude to us. And in the process, the paradox is, in the process, what they are, of course, because we're dealing in the language of politics, is they use rude words about us. So apparently, Mike McNair is childish and jumps up and down, you know, in a tantrum. Well, I think we are big enough to take such criticism. But the difference is that we are prepared to talk. We're prepared to debate. We're prepared to exchange opinions in a sharp, honest way. And these comrades aren't. And that's the difference. And so what we have with these comrades, I think, is a sort of project to pick up the flotsam and jetsam of the left. People have been hurt by membership of what we call the confessional sects. That's an insult word, by the way. So is flotsam and jetsam. That can be taken as an insult. Okay. But what they have is that sort of a project. And the appeal is that we're not going to be nasty to you as the leaders of the confessional sect are. Well, we readily say that we don't make that commitment. We will be sharp in our disagreements if we think it's necessary. Meanwhile, what they seem to be saying, and this is reading between the lines, I admit, is that what they're saying to the leaders of the confessional sects is that we're not going to be rude to you. We're not going to criticize you. Well, I think we should criticize the leaders of the confessional sects. What do we say about Sean McGamner, Martin Thomas, and the social imperialists? Shouldn't we call them social imperialists? What do we say about the Morning Stars, CPB, the SWP? What do we say about these people who preach social pacifism when it comes to the Ukraine war? Don't we criticize them as social pacifists? What do we say about the pro-Kremlin left? Don't we call them a pro-Kremlin left? Is that language not permitted? I think language like that is necessary. And if you don't use language like that, then what you're doing is actually leaving honest politics and going into diplomatic maneuvering and diplomatic deals. And that goes hand in hand. And this is the danger. And we've seen it so many times of bureaucracies silencing critical voices to their left. So in left unity, we don't want critical voices on the left. No heckling, no horrible language. We had it in a whole series of different organizations. And if you want that, what you end up with is the unity of how should I put it, the unity on the basis of not principle, but expediency. Anyway, we shall publish their letter. You can read their letter. We will be replying to their letter. But in all truth, comrades, have a read of the letter. I will challenge anyone who can find any serious politics in it other than what I've implied. There's no politics in it. So what we have is them writing their our article in the Weekly Worker, where they don't mention the Weekly Worker, they don't mention the CPGB, and they don't mention what their differences are with us. So their difference that they're the only difference that they're proclaiming at the moment is we're prepared to talk, and they're not prepared to talk. That's it. Thank you, Gabby.